The 30 pieces of silver our politicians have sold us out for.
I always, when I think about how politicians make deals to sell out their community, that's where 30 pieces of silver comes in, because for me, I was inspired by the story of Judas, and I'm a Christian. So in the story of Judas, Judas was a disciple of Christ. But Judas at the time was more influenced by the money. And I think about that as it relates to today's politics, where people are voting against their interests or voting against the interests of the communities that they have been, that they pledged to represent. And it hasn't gone well. And consequently, I think that in order for us to see this, I was trying to show parallels between what happened with Judas and Christ and what is happening with us now.
That's environmental activist and MacArthur Genius Awardee, Catherine Coleman Flowers. We talk with her about her new collection of essays, Holy Ground, on activism, environmental justice, and finding hope. She shares her journey from Lowndes County, Alabama, to the national stage, her deep roots in faith and family, and her fight for sanitation justice, climate action, and dignity for all. Then vegan advocate Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau joins us to talk about her book, A Year of Compassion, 52 Weeks of Living Zero Waste, Plant-Based, and Cruelty-Free. She offers practical steps to live with compassion for animals, people, and the planet, showing that small changes add up to big impacts. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Catherine Coleman Flowers grew up poor in Lowndes County, Alabama, in the heart of the Black Belt. The daughter of civil rights activists, she was heir to a tradition of fighting for social justice. She grew up to become an internationally recognized activist for environmental justice, most notably, sanitation justice. If you don't know what that is, think about how you probably take for granted access to adequate waste treatment, whether you have a septic system or are linked to a municipal sewage treatment plant. That's not something people in Lowndes County can take for granted. But when Coleman Flowers took up the challenge to change that, she built a movement that extended far beyond her home county. In her collection of essays, Holy Ground, Catherine Coleman Flowers reflects on her life's work at the intersection of civil rights, environmental justice, and faith. She recalls her genealogical ties to the historic Battle of Holy Ground, her fight to expose sanitation crises in poor communities, and her surprising collaborations across political divides. With a message rooted in both realism and hope, Coleman Flowers calls for respect for Mother Earth, bridging divides, and holding on to faith. Catherine Coleman Flowers, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I have been eager to talk with you for a long time, so when I heard about your new book, I jumped on it. I'm a big fan of yours.
Thank you.
This book of essays, although I actually would call them stories because they are so compelling and so beautifully written. You begin the book, Holy Ground, by talking about how Jesus Christ was betrayed by 30 pieces of silver. You draw a parallel to how the powerful, not only in this country, but in the world, are selling out humanity for money. And you say we need to transform values. Say more about that. What are the values that we need to transform to?
Well, I think it's very important for us to, first of all, have a deep respect for Mother Earth. You know, I grew up understanding that Mother Nature was powerful, but she also provides for us, and we have to make sure that what she provides for us, will last for generations to come, that we're not greedy. At my home recently, I put up a bird feeder. And in this bird feeder, I can see the different types of birds come in my backyard to eat the seeds. And when they eat the seeds, they drop the seeds on the ground. When they drop the seeds on the ground, then I see the squirrels would go and eat the seeds that are on the ground. It only becomes a problem when someone becomes greedy. So a raccoon came into my yard, and the raccoon tore down the bird feeder. Nobody else was able to eat. So the parallels are that even in nature, I've just saw examples of that, where everybody was living peacefully because there was like an interdependence where when the birds got the bird seeds and it fell on the ground, then the squirrels were able to eat. But when the raccoon got greedy, nobody was able to eat. Likewise with Mother Earth and our respect for the environment, we have to make sure that it'll be here for the generations to come. And I feel that, you know, a lot of people for money will change their values. And when they think, when they get the money, they don't think about what is happening with people from around the world and how it could vastly create the kind of imbalance where, you know, the future generations may not be able to survive.
You know, it's so funny that you mentioned that, because this morning I myself was looking at my bird feeder and I was watching the birds, and I remarked to myself how they all seem to take turns with each other. Everybody got a piece.
Exactly. It's not even a hierarchy in nature, it's a respect. And I think if we have this respect for these values and I always, when I think about how politicians make deals to sell out their community, that's where 30 pieces of silver comes in. Because for me, I was inspired by the story of Judas, and I'm a Christian. So in the story of Judas, Judas was a disciple of Christ. But Judas at the time was more influenced by the money. And I think about that as it relates to today's politics, where people are voting against their interests or voting against the interests of the communities that they have been, that they pledged to represent, and it hasn't gone well. And consequently, I think that in order for us to see this, I was trying to show parallels between what happened with Judas and Christ and what is happening with us now.
You are motivated very much by your faith. Talk about your faith and how it animates your work.
Well, my faith is one of the things that has kept me grounded through everything that I've been through. You know, all my 60 plus years on earth and all the things that I've dealt with living through the civil rights movement and hearing the stories of lynchings and, you know, families being displaced. I'm big into genealogy. But I also feel that we have to be forgiving. And it's because of my faith that I've been able to do the things that I've been able to do. And I can also, step out there and do things just knowing that God is there for me, as long as I'm doing it in the spirit of service. So, you know, as I look at my history, my family's history, is only faith that got me to where I am today. And the fact that when I look at my genealogy and I can see that my makeup as a person, I have DNA from different parts of the world and different intersections in history. You know, when I look and I see that I have Portuguese ancestry, I think about the slave trade. And then I look at my Dutch ancestry, same thing. It's just all of these things that intersect with my African ancestry. And then I look at my Indian, my Native American ancestry. And in one of the stories, I talk about the Battle of Holy Ground and how potentially I know that I had people that were on both sides of that battle, fighting with Native Americans and fighting against Native Americans. But to not be dismayed. My faith has allowed me to see it for what it is and to take the good and use that to try to serve humanity.
Yeah, your book is called Holy Ground. Say a little bit more about Holy Ground, the battle, but also the deep personal meaning that that place has for you.
Wow. So Holy Ground is this beautiful place along the Alabama River. And it was holy to the indigenous people at that time. And the battle occurred because settlers were moving into their territory, and there were several different attacks as a result. And they sent in Andrew Jackson, who at that time was not a, this was before he was elected president. And he ended up coming down with a group of people to put down, quote, and I'm saying this in quotes, put down this battle, this rebellion, if you will. And it happened along the Alabama River in Lowndes County, Alabama, which is where I'm from. And there were people that were at the Battle of Holy Ground that were indigenous, but I found out that there were also African Americans that were there. And when I found this out, this was after I had actually been at a ceremony at Holy Ground with Corinna Gore and the Climate Reality Project. We did a climate training in Lowndes County, Alabama, and for some reason, I just felt the need that we should start it off with a ceremony, an earth-honoring ceremony at the site of the Battle of Holy Ground. And when we went to Holy Ground for this, we didn't think that a lot of people would show up, but there were more people than we anticipated that would be there that early in the morning that had come from all over the state. And this particular ceremony was led by people who were indigenous. And we stood in a circle. And before standing in that circle, we were told to pick up soil from the earth. And we had it in our hands. We dug the soil with our hands and we held it. But we had our eyes closed. And during this ceremony, I could feel the soil moving in my hand. I thought I had picked up a word. But in addition to that, you could literally hear the fish jumping out of the Alabama River. And then a flock of birds flew over us and started singing. It was the most amazing thing that I had ever seen. And after the ceremony was over, they said, "Now you can speak and tell us who among us are indigenous." And almost everybody in the circle had indigenous ancestry. And they took the dirt and put it in a container and gave it to me as a gift. And I still have that dirt today. And I feel that my connection to Holy Ground, I didn't know at that time until I started doing the genealogical studies that I actually had ancestors that were there as well. So It was very powerful to me. And still, whenever I wanted to, you know, calm my anxiety, I would go to Holy Ground because it's very, very peaceful now. And I felt that maybe my ancestors were speaking to me.
You had, I guess there were, one of the people who was escaping during that battle went from one side of the river to the other, which was going from your father's family side to your mother's family side.
Exactly. William Weatherford. William Weatherford actually jumped. They said he jumped off the cliff into that area, escaping during the Battle of Holy Ground. And I was doing the genealogical study. I took a DNA test. And one of my relatives, she lives in Montana now. We were going back and forth, exchanging messages. And then she said, because she's, you know, she's white. And she said to me afterwards, she said, "Catherine, I know how we're related now." I said, "How are we related?" She said, "Through William Weatherford, because he was my grandmother's great-grandfather."
That's amazing. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm speaking with environmental justice activist Catherine Coleman Flowers about her collection of essays about her life, Holy Ground. And when you say holy ground, you do really link that in with how you found through genealogical research that you have roots all over the planet. And one could say that the entire planet is holy ground.
Exactly. It is. I mean, the fact that we have been so blessed to be in this Garden of Eden that provides for us, but we're not supposed to destroy it. where the people that come after us cannot take advantage of it. If we have clean water, why do we contaminate it? There's so many resources, I think, that we have that are naturally here that we could use for the purpose of making each of our lives more wholesome and healthier, as opposed to just export to we cannot do it, that it no longer exists. So I would like to think that, again, going back to my faith, I grew up in the church and going to Sunday school, and I just remember these pictures of the Garden of Eden. And we have literally been given a Garden of Eden. Why should we destroy it and try to find another planet as opposed to maintaining and cultivating and nurturing what we already have? And that's part of the message that I like to give in the book, not just the planet, but relationships and people. We have to not discard people, no matter where they are in the world. And we have to also be able to make those connections so that we can all live the type of life of peace, and also have the an abundance, I think, means different things to different people, but to be able to have what is needed for everyone to have a decent standard of living.
Mm. And this brings us to what you actually have called your calling in the book. That is your activism around sanitation justice in poor communities. A previous book of yours is called Waste. And I remember watching a video that was put out by the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2019 that you were responsible for. I didn't know that at the time. You invited the senator to Lowndes County in Alabama to talk with your friend Pamela Rush, someone whose septic system was completely dysfunctional. Tell us about her condition, what she was facing there, which is typical of that area.
Well, Pamela was a mom. She had two children, and she lived in a single white mobile home. And that mobile home that she lived in, they had bought it years before and still owed more on the home than the home was worth. And she was actually straight piping, meaning that when she flushed the toilet, it went out onto the ground. Inside of her home, it was full of mold and mildew. And a lot of it, I think, was because it's so warm and moist in Lowndes County that the weather is almost tropical. So a lot of the materials that I'm sure the home was made of was not resilient. And it also was not the type of home that was meant to be in long term. And she had been there for many years. So when the UN Special Rapporteur in Extreme Poverty visited Lowndes County, and when he visited Lowndes County, he came right at the time we had issued the parasite study where we found evidence of hookworm and other tropical parasites in Lowndes County. And when we found that, when they came and they saw that, he said that the conditions that he saw were not something that they expected to see in a country like the United States. It was more akin to something they would see in an underdeveloped nation. And he went from the special rapporteur, went from Lowndes County to D.C. and was sharing this with Senator Sanders, Bernie Sanders. And I received a call from Senator Sanders saying that he wanted me to come to Washington and talk about Lowndes County. And I did go to Washington. And while I was there, I invited him to come and visit Lowndes County and see it for himself. And he did come. And when he came, he visited Pamela Rush. And when he visited her home, He was so moved. She said to him, "I'm poor. I just want to be able to take care of my family." He said, "I'm going to send help." And that was through his inviting me to join the Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force on climate change. And it was there that I met a lot of people, which led to a lot of the contacts that I made, where I was able to expand and expose the sanitation issue beyond the areas that had already covered it. Because a lot of people in the United States at that time still didn't realize that this was a problem as widespread as it is, not just in Lowndes County, but throughout the United States. And we're still struggling to try to find long-term solutions.
But on the way to finding them, it was a very interesting essay. I'm not sure it's just in one essay, but Catherine Coleman Flowers, you emphasize in the book the potential for transformation by some of even the most odious racists. And I'm thinking about your work with Senator Jeff Sessions. You worked with Sessions on getting sanitation justice for poor Black families in Alabama. Tell us about that. And then I want to follow that up with a question about, you know, what kinds of lessons can be drawn from that more generally.
Well, with Senator Sessions, we met at a town hall meeting in Fort Deposit, Alabama. And he was talking about the type of funding that was available for rural communities that he had supported. And my question to him is, how can rural communities get these funds when they're required to have a match, a 25% match at that time, and they do not have a tax base to provide the match? And he couldn't answer the question. And he said, he came to me afterwards. He said, "I've always wondered about that, and I want to do something about it, but I don't know what to do." And I respected him for saying that. And we decided that we would work together. And he was, with that particular issue, he went on to tell me later that he had grown up poor in Wilcox County, Alabama, which is another Black Belt county. And we started working together. He helped us when we wanted to get two tier one suppliers to Hyundai to come to Lowndes County, because the theory was if we got these manufacturers to come there and provide these jobs for the community, then they could pay for the septic systems, because we thought that it was that simple. But it's not that simple. And even though we were able to get the tier one suppliers to come, that paradigm didn't work or shift anything for people that lived in the county. But he was a very, very good friend and supporter. When President Obama was elected, I remember his office contacted me and asked me how many tickets did I want to the inauguration. And when I went to the inauguration, they had these booklets that they had collected for me that are collector's items now. And they said, and I remember his staff person saying, "We knew that you would want this." So I think that we have to continue to engage and have conversation, because a lot of the racism, I think, is fed by stuff that's not true. And I think that it is easier to help people move away from that once they learn the true history and how we're all connected in some way. And even if we just try to work together and find out we can work together, and then in the course of that, we start talking about other things. And that's how we bridge those gaps.
And that was a surprising story, because I've only ever really thought of Jeff Sessions as somebody who would not be open to that kind of thing. But it leads to a deeper question, and here we'll move to climate. You point out that the richest 1% of the world population, 1%, produced as much carbon pollution in 2019 as the 5 billion people who made up the poorest two-thirds of humanity. It's an utterly phenomenal figure. And it leads you to the question, and I'll quote you here, how is it possible to take a global view of climate change in a way that incorporates the differences in power, resources, and wealth among all the countries on the planet? You say it's simple to suggest that the rich countries should carry the burden for the poor ones, but the barriers to doing this are enormous, and time is of the essence. For me, this is the $64 trillion question. I think it's exactly this overwhelming power of the tiny group of billionaires that makes it seem so impossible to accomplish anything on time on climate. Do you have a theory of change that gives a path for us to save the world before it's too late?
I think that we're going to have to bring these billionaires to places like Lowndes County, places that they've never seen before, so they can see what's going on. One of the things that we've been very fortunate about is being able to bring people to see it for themselves, and people share their experiences and they go away changed. And I think that if we could target and those people that want to come and want to learn and come with an open mind and see what we have and what we can do to change it, I think it can make all the difference in the world. I also feel that we have to have the ability to talk to each other. You know, I remember saying that we can either live together or we'll die together as fools. So we have to find a way to have those conversations. You know, growing up in the South, I've learned how to go into places where I'm probably the only Black person there, but I have to find some commonality. I know if I'm in Alabama, if I want to start a conversation, I could start it over Alabama or Auburn. Football, you know, things that people can agree on. And that's where it begins. Or we can start talking about the fact that we're grandparents, you know, or I find out that person has a 2-year-old and I have a 2-year-old granddaughter. And we started talking about 2-year-olds. We have to find ways to bridge these gaps and not be at each other's throats all the time, because we're not going to get anywhere. And the people that own the most need to come and see the people that don't have that much.
You have a very moving chapter about the death of your mother, who was also a civil rights activist, as was your father, and you were very, very close to her. I don't think we have time to go into that story, but I was struck by, in that chapter, you say, you know, it was a very dark time for you when she died. In fact, she was murdered. But you say, in the darkest of times, hope is still possible. Indeed, it is essential. And you say there are so many reasons to feel hopeful. So I'm going to ask you, please give us a few.
Well, I think there are many reasons to feel hopeful. You know, one of the things that we say a lot, you know, I'm a country girl from Lowndes County, Alabama. And usually when we greet each other, we start off by saying we're hopeful because we woke up this morning. You know, that's one reason to be hopeful. We're hopeful because we're not hungry. You know, we're hopeful because we have water. And those of us that are living in the throes of climate change and these soaring heat indexes, if you have air conditioning and you're not on the street during this time, that's a reason to be hopeful. We can also be hopeful because of the young people that are still out there working to bring about change, that care more about the community and the earth than they care just about themselves. You know, I'm also hopeful because the values that I've learned from my religious experiences taught me that we have to remain hopeful. That's how we get to change. And all the people that I've met around the world as a result of the work that I've done that I never would have met otherwise, all of that brings me hope. I'm hopeful because I grew up in a poor school system and I won a MacArthur Genius Award. You know, I'm hopeful because I never thought I would be on the cover of Time magazine. I'm a poor Black girl from Lowndes County, Alabama. I'm hopeful because I have learned that hard work pays off. And I'm hopeful because of all the young people that reach out to me every day asking for guidance and wanted to be involved and make a difference. So those are the things that make me hopeful.
You know, what strikes me about what you say are two things. One is that part of being hope is being grateful, you know, is being looking around and being having gratitude for what you do have. And the other part of being hopeful is that being hopeful is a choice. It's not up to the world to necessarily give you hope. It's up to you to make the hope.
Yes, and you also, it depends on your perspective and how you look at it. Because if you're down and out, you're not going to take the actions to make the change that you're seeking. So, you know, you have to look at the glasses, whether it's half empty or half full. And for me, the glass is always half full. And if I want to add more to it, then I have to take that step to make it happen. Because in my faith tradition, I'm taught that if you make one step, God would make two.
And that's beautiful. And it's just been so, so beautiful to talk with you, Catherine Coleman Flowers, about your book, Holy Ground, on Activism, Environmental Justice, and Finding Hope. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for this opportunity.
Catherine Coleman Flowers is the founder of the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice. Her previous book was Waste, One Woman's Fight Against America's Dirty Secret. Next up, how small changes made by enough people can change the world. Stay tuned after the break. And welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. On September 21st, people all over the U.S. and abroad will be celebrating Sunday. That's on a Saturday, so the celebration is not about the day of the week, but about the cheapest, most abundant, and cleanest form of power, solar power. At a time when the Trump regime is trying to drag us back to the dirty dark ages, it's important to remember that there's a lot that we can do individually to protect our environment and our climate. Apart from putting solar panels on our houses or tapping into community solar, we can also adopt a climate-friendly diet, decrease our use of plastics, and look out for the wild creatures we share the planet with. It's all about living our lives with compassion for the earth and its denizens. My guest, Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau, shares with us her wisdom from her book, A Year of Compassion, 52 Weeks of Living Zero Waste, Plant-Based, and Cruelty-Free. With humor, humility, and practical tips, she shows how compassion is not weakness, but an active force for change, and how small steps toward zero waste and plant-based living can transform lives and communities. Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. Lovely to be here.
This book is titled A Year of Compassion, 52 Weeks of Living Zero Waste, Plant-Based, and Cruelty-Free. Why did you center this book on compassion rather than, say, sustainability or veganism?
Yeah, thank you for asking. It was very intentional. Compassion has always been the foundation of the work I do, and the work I do has always been around animal advocacy and living lightly on this earth and eating in a way that is reflecting that. And because compassion has always been the foundation of my work, it just felt authentic to base the topics of how we eat, how we live, you know, how we perceive and treat each other and other animals, to make that the foundation. But really, the shorter answer is because compassion is all about connection. Compassion is all about interconnectedness. And there's nothing we do, there's no choice we make that doesn't have an impact on someone or something else. So how can I not frame these topics of, you know, living sustainably and eating plant-based and treating animals with kindness? How can I not base that in compassion? We're all connected, and I wanted that to get across.
And this comes at a time when it seems that we live in a culture of ever more cruelty, that cruelty is what's valued and not compassion. How do you talk to people about compassion being a powerful active force rather than something that expresses weakness?
You know, I want to first respond to what you said about living in a time of cruelty. I think we live less in a time of, certainly, you know, people wouldn't frame and characterize their behavior as cruel. So what I think it is more is a lack of awareness that we are connected. I think there's more disconnectedness, right? There's less of an awareness that what I do impacts you, that we are connected, that there's no way around that. And so, you know, I say this in the introduction about, you know, kind of answering the question, why am I framing this book around compassion? If compassion is about connectedness, the opposite is not cruelty. The opposite of compassion isn't cruelty. The opposite is disconnectedness. And so that's how I convey this. That's how I communicate this with other people, is not to say you're cruel, you need to be compassionate. You're cruel, you need to be kind. What you're doing is not kind. Let's be kind. What I want to say is, you're already a good, kind, compassionate person. How is that being manifested in your behavior? And if you do consider yourself a compassionate person, how is it being manifested? And how is it not being manifested? So it's more holding all of us, myself included, accountable for recognizing that what I do has an impact and that I don't get to choose if I can make a difference, right? I've said this for years. We don't get to choose whether we can make a difference or not. We get to choose only if the difference we make is negative or positive. And so that's what I want to do in my work, in this book, is empower people to make the choices that are going to reflect their values and that are going to reflect, do I want to do this? Do I want to be kind or not? Do I want to have a negative impact or do I want to have a positive impact? And that's what I try to set out to do, to empower people to do that and not think about me and my ethics and what I'm asking them to do, but think about their ethics and their values and what they really want to do to reflect them.
You know, and I think what's so important about what you say is that you're not coming to people from a judgmental place. You're coming from a place of what can you do? How does the way you live reflect your values, as you just said? What you're doing is you're sidestepping the culture wars. You're inviting people to express themselves in a more authentic way. And I think that that's really beautiful. And one way you do that is by talking about small steps. So tell us about your approach. Let's say you do come up to somebody for whom this is all new. You know, they're a meat eating person. They think that people who are vegans are, you know, kind of woo-woo and they're communists. How do you approach somebody like that?
So I approach all of this because, you know, we live in a non-vegan world. I've been vegan for 26 years. I'm very aware of people's fears and defenses and what they're holding on to. I try to really remember that I too was once unaware, unwilling, right? I had my own journey of eating meat my entire childhood into my young adulthood, realizing what I was contributing to, making a change, but not going all the way. I became vegetarian, was still eating dairy and eggs, was still wearing leather, was still doing things that, you know, had negative impacts. And then eventually had what I call really an awakening. There's no other way to put it. I my eyes were completely open and they have been, and I've kept them open for 26 years. So I can't forget that. And so I really try to approach everyone with that awareness that I too, you know, I'm on this journey. And I think that disarms people. I hope it does. That's what I've noticed, what I've seen, it's what I've heard. And that's what I come at it with, is not me against you and, you know, my righteousness, you know, and your unawareness. I try to come at it with, we're all in this together, and let's stand together against what we both feel is anathema, what we both feel is cruel, what we both feel is not reflecting kindness and sustainability. And how can we approach it together? So I try to approach it as a partner in this, as opposed to, you know, I think I'm, a teacher, but I think we're all teachers, right? I think I'm a conduit, but I think we're all conduits. And so I really honor that role that I play, and I'm aware of it. And so I'm very aware also of that tender moment when there might be defensiveness and there might be judgment on their part, and there might be an assumption that I'm going to be judgment toward them. I'm really aware of that. So I try to use kind of everything I've got, which is my own humor, my own awareness of their fears, my own awareness of their, you know, worry that I'm going to judge them, my own awareness of their being on a journey as well. So I try to just kind of use all of that and come at everyone with a different approach, because it is kind of a unique moment when I'm talking to that person. It's a really a unique moment with each person that I talk to, even if they ask the same question that I've heard a million times, like the protein question or, you know, whatever it is. So I think it's an honor to have these interactions with people. And I mean that.
The protein question, you mean, how am I going to get enough protein if I don't eat meat?
Yeah.
So you've written several acclaimed cookbooks and guides for plant-based living. What made you want to structure a year of compassion as a 52-week journey instead of, say, monthly or even daily?
You know, I used to have, and I keep fantasizing about doing it again, I used to have a daily dose of compassion. It was a newsletter, and I still aspire to do that. I just haven't been able to do it. And it actually was funny because it was inspiration, but it was also action-oriented, because everything I do is action-oriented, because compassion is action oriented. I mean, one of the things that distinguishes compassion from empathy or sympathy or altruism is action. So I've always been action oriented, but the daily dose of compassion was inspirational. It was kind of, you know, inspiring people to think differently as well as behave differently. And it was just getting ahead of me. So it became weekly words of wisdom. And then I just wasn't able to keep up. So I really do want to kind of come back to that. As I thought about it for the book, that was my initial idea. And you know, the publisher kind of steered me toward more of weekly. And when she did, it really resonated, because I feel like if you're giving someone daily actions, it can be overwhelming. And so even though I could have made this daily, I really prefer the weekly structure, because I do think it enables people to process a different way of being, a different way of acting, and make it more possible. So if I'm saying to you, consider reducing your disposable plastic use, you know, you're going to be able to kind of think about what resources are available to you, how you're going to go about doing that, what you have to change over the course of a week, more than you are over the course of a day. And then the next day would be something else, and the next day would be something else. And I think people would, you know, just kind of give up and not do anything at all because they feel overwhelmed. So I really like the weekly structure, and I think it does enable people to process better and actually make it more successful than not.
So you mentioned plastic. I have tried to go plastic free, and it's extraordinarily difficult. And so your frame very much in this book is about do better, not more. Well, even let's just take that as an example. What might be a way for people to do better with plastic? And I don't know too many people who've been able to completely take plastic out of their life.
No, it's 100% difficult. And when I talk about zero waste, it's a tricky word, because, you know, just like vegan is not, there's no such thing as a perfect, you know, vegan. There's no such thing as being perfect. And so zero waste is not even zero, but it's an aspiration. And I look at zero waste as aspirational. And so the truth is, you cannot eliminate plastic 100% from your life. And so I think it would be better to say is the non-reusable plastic, right? So you kind of have to separate out reusable from non-reusable. So, you know, the plastic that we need in the, kind of the medical profession, you know, that does provide sanitary medical treatment. Like, there have been some, you know, revolutionary, very helpful ways that plastic has come into our lives. But where we can reduce or eliminate unnecessary plastic. So what does that look like for you? Now, the first week is actually doing an audit, kind of look at where plastic is coming into your life and where you might be able to eliminate or reduce it from those areas, and being really self-aware and being really honest. And an audit helps you do that. So for me, one of the ways I'm very lucky to be able to reduce certainly flexible plastic, like plastic bags is I never buy plastic bags. Like, I don't buy Ziploc bags. Of course, they come into our lives one way or another. They just do. But we have bulk stores where I can get all of my grains, all of my legumes, even liquid. I can get balsamic vinegar. I can get soy sauce in bulk bins. And I just go with my refillable bags or my refillable containers or jars. And I can do that. Now, can everybody do that? No. Can some people do it sometimes? Yes. Can some people do it for a little bit of, you know, for a few things? Yes. Right. So that's an example where you can find ways to say, well, I still want my beans. I'm not going to, you know, stop buying beans. No, don't stop buying beans. But where can you maybe go get them in bulk? That's one example. You know, certainly washing the plastic bags when you can and reusing them for as long as you can. Great. So that's another example. You know, I tell the story of my blueberries. I love frozen blueberries. It's one of my favorite snacks. It's one of my favorite things to have in the freezer. And I used to buy the Trader Joe's, you know, 10-ounce bags. And when I was on starting this journey, I was like, I feel so guilty. Like, I can't do this. So in some ways, I was able to say, well, for strawberries, I don't have to get strawberries in the plastic, you know, frozen strawberries in the plastic bags. I can go to my farmer's market in this, you know, in the season where strawberries are abundant, and I can get a flat. And then I can freeze them myself. For blueberries, it was getting really hard to do because there's a very short window when they're seasonal. And they're very expensive. Fresh, they're very expensive. So I went without frozen blueberries for a while. And it was, you know, a sacrifice I was willing to make, but it was really hard. So I just kept digging. And then I found Francesca. There's a wonderful company called Azure, A-Z-U-R-E. Azure Standard. They're a distribution company. They've been around for a long time. They focus mostly on organics and a lot of produce, and including, you know, grains and beans. And they found a way to be able to sell directly to individuals in bulk what they would typically sell to stores and restaurants, you know, grocery stores and restaurants. So they have volunteers who volunteer to manage a drop-off location once a month. So we literally now found a way. I order my frozen blueberries. We meet a truck off an exit on the side of a road, which sounds bizarre. I feel like we're doing a drug deal. And I get 30 pounds of blueberries in one large box. Now, there is a large plastic bag, but it's a large bag and it's a thick bag. And I can reuse that bag almost like a garbage bag. Like, it's a very thick plastic. And I can use that bag over and over and over and over and over again. But it's at least not the small plastic stretchy bag from Trader Joe's, right? Now, is everyone going to be willing to go through that? No, but I'm willing to do that so that I can get my frozen blueberries tick. And then I can also not, you know, throw out these small individual plastic bags tick. The other thing I did, and I'll tell you one more resource, there's a wonderful company called Ridwell. It's kind of like TerraCycle. So for your listeners, they might want to check out both. Ridwell is in certain cities, but they're now starting to do mail-in disposal. So they are a wonderful company that basically once every 2 weeks, I pay to have them pick up both the what they call plastic film, which is the example of the plastic bag that a frozen fruit would come in, and thicker multi-layer plastic, like what tofu or potato chips would come in, like kind of that multi-layer plastic. And they have partners and ways to either recycle or, you know, upcycle those materials. So there are so many resourceful, innovative people and companies finding solutions for these things. So that is a solution. It's still not perfect because you still have the manufacturing of the plastic, which is petroleum-based. So where we can reduce, let's reduce. Where we can find solutions, let's do it. Where we can make some changes and maybe some sacrifices, let's do it. And where we can find resources of other people who are trying to solve this, you know, on a higher level, companies, et cetera, let's do it, right? So it's a matter of how much we're willing to do. But I will say it does take, you know, a little more effort because, you know, you mentioned again, cruelty. I think people are solving solving for cruelty as much as they're solving for convenience. So some of it might be inconvenient for people. Some people might say, no, I'm willing to do it, right? We have to just be honest. If we want to make a difference, we have to do something different. I mean, that's just the reality. So those are kind of some ways I've been able to get around that soft plastic issue.
And considering each of us consumes about a credit card's worth of plastic every day, it's in our air, our water, and our soil, and our food, and everything, long-term, that's really cancer is a lot more inconvenient, let's just say. But you also make a point in this book that lifestyle alone doesn't make it, that you also have to combine that with, or you recommend combining with how you vote and advocate for things. And here in New York State right now, unfortunately, we had it just down to the wire and it failed, but there was a Plastics Reduction and Recycling Act that people have been working on for several years. Unfortunately, we have a leader of our state assembly who has been dead set against almost every, a Democrat who has been dead set against almost every single environmental bill that we bring up. But the fight is not over. So talk a little bit about that combination of, you know, personal action and action in the world.
Absolutely. So one is individual action, some of the things we're talking about. Another one is coming from the business sector. And then legislation is another one. And it is true. The fight is not over. The fight will never be over. And the fight will always be a fight. There is never a world in which this is going to just settle, be done, be over. We know that. We've seen really significant legislation be overturned. We never thought that would happen. We think once the bill's done, the Supreme Court, it's done, it's in the Constitution, it would never be changed. It's not true. We always have to stay vigilant. At the moment in time we're in, this will change when we're gone, and it has been different before we came. So I just wanted to say that, like, we have to stay vigilant, but we also have to know that we can do the best we can, and it's still not going to be over. I say that to actually be hopeful, not to actually be skeptical, because this is what it looks like. So absolutely, we have to hold accountable the people who are our voice in Congress, whether it's statewide, whether it's local city council, or whether it's the federal government. And we're going to win some and we're going to lose some. And in the next term, we're going to win some and we're going to lose some, but we can never stop. So we have to realize that the people who are in these positions of influence, they are working for us. And, you know, I've heard this, and I heard this many, many years ago, and it's stuck with me. I've never forgotten it. I'm sure you've heard it as well, is for every letter that a representative receives, it represents 100 other voices that didn't write in. So do not underestimate the letter you write, the email you write, the call you make. They are waiting to hear from you. And when they don't hear from their constituents, they think, well, they don't care. It's not important to them. So even if you have like-minded representatives like I do here in California, I'm very, very lucky. First of all, you can never just rest on your laurels. Second of all, they have to be held accountable too, because there might be things, you mentioned a Democrat, you might assume that they're on board with you and they might not be, or they might need the push that you can give them. So we absolutely have to make sure that we're vigilant. There's amazing lobbyists who are doing the hard work. I'm not a lobbyist. I don't want to go to DC. I don't want to, that's not my work. That's not my job, but I can pick up a phone and I can, you know, send an email and I can write a letter and let them know that I want them to pass or reject a particular bill. So that's, I think, what we absolutely have to do, every single solitary one of us, because we know voting matters and it has consequences.
So let's go back to some of the details. You have a message of stop seeing food as garbage. And what are the changes when we begin to treat food, even scraps, with respect and intention?
Well, I think that's the first part of it, is actually seeing them as valuable, right? So having intention around the food. I mean, I do really recommend in that chapter saying grace, expressing gratitude, whatever that looks like for you, however that sounds to you, before eating food, and recognizing the energy and the resources and the people and the animals that were sacrificed or that worked to make this possible. So I think intention is the first part. When you see that there's value in the food that came to you, you treat it differently. You see it differently. That goes for everything in our lives. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is also, again, kind of part of that audit, recognizing what we discard before we even start eating it, because it's been sitting in our refrigerator and it started composting in the refrigerator. Did we not store it properly so that it started breaking down before we were able to even eat it? Well, what responsibility can we take to make sure that it gets to our bellies right? So there's quite a few chapters in the book around reducing food rot in our refrigerators. Before we even get to like the composting part, how are we treating the food so that we can, you know, prolong its life before we eat it? And one of the answers to that is eating it. So not treating our refrigerator like a storage unit and not buying more than we are actually able to eat. And if we realize that we're not able to eat it in the time period before it starts to disintegrate, then maybe we can freeze it. Maybe we can turn it into something else. Maybe we can make lemonade literally from the lemons that are about to go bad before they go bad. So there are lots of different ways we can treat the food, but all of it comes from first realizing that it is valuable. And then there is the part of discard. You know, then there is the, let's use, first of all, the food for everything we can get out of it. The lemons are a great example. So I mentioned making lemonade, but also the rind on those lemons. I cannot tell you, Francesca, how much I love lemon zest and how much flavor it brings to everything you make. Everything you make. I love lemon zest. So before you even squeeze those lemons to make lemonade or whatever you make with the lemon juice, get the rind off and get the zest off, and put it in a little container. You can freeze it. You can keep it in the refrigerator and then add it to whatever you are making. It literally from pasta sauce or pasta to a tofu scramble to a stir fry, whatever you're making, use that zest. So you get the idea. See the value in every bit of that vegetable, that food, that fruit. Stock is another great example. Once you have exhausted everything, once you have chopped off all of the, you know, the food scraps that you're not going to eat when you're making a salad, put those in a separate bowl. Sure, keep them in the freezer until it takes a few days to build up. And then you make a stock from them. And then you get this gorgeous vegetable stock that you've made that, again, you can freeze or you can put in your refrigerator, use it for soups, use it for stews, use it for stir fries, use it for anything. And now you've just taken the value out of all of the food. Does that make sense? I think it's that value that we see in the food that enables us to take as much from it as we can. And then we can discard it properly before we put it in a landfill.
You also talk about compassion with animals, rescuing animals. And this is an interesting inclusion. After I interviewed the author Cy Montgomery about one of her books, which is about turtles and tortoises, I put a little turtle rescue box in my car. Talk about keeping emergency animal rescue kits in your car. What inspired this for you? And how can ordinary people prepare to help animals in distress?
Well, first of all, thank you for doing that. And I want to say for people who are concerned about turtles, I will say this. Mowing lawns and having lawns is one of the things that one of the main reasons that turtles are in decline. They get mowed. They don't have the ability to find shelter and food. So very short, if people can reduce their lawns, if they can eliminate them completely and plant instead native plants, that would be the best thing. But if you could just at least reduce your lawns by 50%, it would save so many animals, including turtles. So you can imagine the inspiration for me was actually encountering a situation like I think most of us do. I really think many of us have been in the situation where we see an animal in distress or, you know, a dead animal or a dying animal on the side of the road, you know, in a situation where we want to help and we don't have the means to do so. Means being the box we need, the gloves we need, the leash we need, the food we need to entice them. So I'm talking about wildlife, but also domesticated animals, you know, cats and dogs included. So it's just such a simple thing to just be prepared. And being prepared, again, starts with mentally being prepared, just knowing that when you go about your day, you may encounter an animal who needs your help. And that's the first thing, just kind of knowing that, you know, maybe including buffer in your time when you're going out to run some errands, certainly as you're driving along, being mindful of it and knowing that you might be called upon to help someone. Then the second part, the practical preparation, is actually having a box in your car, like you said, or gloves. Just throw some gardening gloves in your trunk, or a leash, or some, you know, dog treats. You know, keep them sealed and keep them in your trunk and, you know, replenish them maybe every 3 months because they'll go stale or what have you. So it's just a way of being prepared. because I've been in so many situations where it was, you know, a stray dog, stray cat. And, you know, if you don't have what you need, then you can't help. The other way of being prepared, not just with the box or the gloves, is actually having in your phone the phone number of animal rescue groups, whether it's the local shelter, you know, for dogs and cats and birds and rabbits, et cetera, but also wildlife rescue. Because again, you know, there's always that moment where we're panicking and we're scared and they're injured and we don't know what to do and we don't know who to call. And that goes for when you're traveling. Before you go to the towns you're going to go to, put in your phone, find out who the rescue groups are, for who to call if you find a stray dog or if you find a stray cat or if you find someone in distress. You'll be able to call and you will feel so much better as opposed to being stressed. You might even not have, you know, Wi-Fi where you are in that moment. So how are you going to find the phone number of someone to call? So just being prepared in those ways, I think just makes a huge difference and certainly will make a huge difference in the life of whoever you're trying to help.
That's great. So of course, veganism is a key component of this book. What does it mean to plantify meals? And why is that more approachable than going cold turkey?
Look, don't do nothing because you can't do everything, do something, anything. I have heard for so many years people say, it's so funny because people will, you know, hear that I'm vegan and immediately people tell you what they eat when you tell them you're vegan. This is why it's so interesting that people think vegans talk about it. People want to know and people want to do something, but they get overwhelmed because they think they have to do everything. So every time I tell someone I'm vegan, the first thing people do is tell me what they eat. And often they say, oh, you know, I don't really care about beef. I don't really eat it. I don't eat pork, but oh, I can never give up cheese, whatever they say. And I say, well, what are you eating now? And they say, well, I'm eating everything. I'm eating beef and I'm eating pork and I'm eating cheese. And I say, well, if you say you can stop eating these two things because you don't really like them, then why don't you just stop eating them and fine, eat cheese, but at least you're doing something. And they go, I never thought of that. Like they never thought to just at least start somewhere, right? So wherever you want to start, can start, be self-honest. Just don't do nothing because you can't do everything. Do something. So wherever people can start. Now, what I do in the book, and I think it's chapter two, is I say, listen, eat less meat. Here's the deal. If you want to not contribute to cruelty and violence against animals, the best thing you can do is not contribute to cruelty and violence against animals by not eating them at all. There is no world in which there is a way to say you can commit a little bit of violence. There is violence and there's no violence. So from the animal's perspective, 100% not eating animals and animal secretions, dairy, eggs, is 100% the best thing we can do to not contribute to violence against them. If you want to quantify and measure the environmental impacts, then you can do that. And I do that in the book. The number one thing we can stop eating is beef, because of the impacts it has on the land, on wildlife, on the resources, the amount of flesh we get off of this animal relative to the amount of water and resources we've had to put into growing that animal before they're slaughtered. It's just the most ridiculous ratio. So beef, lamb are the top two, you know, mutton, all of that. And then the next would be chickens and birds, and pork. And the next would be dairy. So if you need to quantify it, but just don't do nothing, do something. And that's what I would say to people. 100%, you know, going 100% plant-based is going to be the best thing. But I've been vegan, you know, Francesca, for 26 years, and I've been advocating for 26 years. And I know there hasn't been that much of a shift. There's been a huge shift in non-vegans eating more plants and eating fewer animal products. And I think that is where it's going to lie, is people continuing to reduce, just because I need to be practical about this. But again, I will say, if you want to do the most amount of good for yourself, for your health, for the environment, for the animals, it is 100% plant-based. But if you're at least willing to start somewhere, then start somewhere and don't delay.
And in fact, you say that reducing animal products is more impactful when many people do it imperfectly. That if you are demanding perfection, fewer people will do it and the impact will be less. But to encourage at least reduction will have a much greater impact.
Yeah, and that's a message for advocates even more than it's a message for individuals hearing that, because for individuals hearing that, like, as I said, for them, you know, 100% plant-based is going to be the best thing you can do. But literally, if that's all you tell people, that it's either that or nothing, that's completely self-defeatist. So the point being, you know, the truth is a few people going meat-free, more people going meat-free a couple days a week has more impact than a few, you know, percentage points of people becoming 100% vegan. So from an advocacy perspective, you know, just encourage people to do anything they can do, which is what I'm doing, right? From a practical perspective, if you're hearing this, you know, I don't want people to get complacent and say, oh, well, no, you know, if I just do a little bit, and they do a little bit, it's fine. I'll just do a little bit then. That's why I always say self-honesty is so important. So that's what I mean by that. But absolutely, everything you do will have an impact, and encourage everybody around you to keep doing that. You know, Meatless Mondays became very popular. The problem is, and I'm sure you know this, the problem is there is our perception of what we do and there is what we do. And they don't always match, because most people think they eat a lot fewer animal products than they do. So that's why, again, in that first chapter, it's about an audit. So that first chapter is doing a food audit and it's doing a waste audit. It's a consumption audit. So be honest with yourself. Do an audit. Really look at how much you're eating during the day, during the week, how much you're feeding your family. And you might have a better sense. And if after that you look at that and you go, yeah, I really could reduce more, then do that and keep going until you feel like it's reflecting what you really want.
Well, the book is A Year of Compassion, 52 Weeks of Living Zero Waste, Plant-Based and Cruelty-Free. It's just been great to talk with you, Colleen Patrick-Goudreau.
Thank you so much, Francesca. Really enjoyed it.
Well, the book is A Year of Compassion, 52 Weeks of Living Zero Waste, Plant-Based and Cruelty-Free. It's just been great to talk with you, Colleen Patrick-Goudreau.
Thank you so much, Francesca. Really enjoyed it.
Colleen Patrick-Goudreau is the award-winning author of 7 books, including the best-selling The Joy of Vegan Baking, among other vegan cookbooks. She's the producer of the podcast Food for Thought. Find a link at writersvoice.net, and we'll also put a link there to the nationwide activities for Sunday, where you can find out how you can participate. Next week, in keeping with the build-up to Sunday and Climate Week at the UN, we talk with Andrew Fishman about How to Save the Amazon, the posthumous book written by Don Phillips, who was murdered along with Bruno Pereira by a gang of environmental criminals in the Brazilian Amazon. Andrew Fishman and others completed the book after Phillips' death. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.